Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. Adam Boileau is back on deck with us this week. He'll be joining us for a chat about the week's security news in just a moment. And after that, it's time for this week's sponsor interview with Stefan Chanet, the CTO and co-founder of Attack IQ. We've been talking about this topic a lot on the show, but with Stefan, we will be talking more about MITRE ATT&CK. As more and more people are using the ATT&CK Matrix, some odd misuses are starting to spring up. So we'll chat about that and a few more things with Stefan Chanet after the week's news. That is coming up later, but first up, of course, it is time for a check of the week's security news headlines with our good friend, Adam Boileau. And Adam, a couple of former Twitter employees have been arrested for apparently spying on some user accounts that may have been of interest to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, this is not a great story for Twitter to have, you know, everyone talking about. And, you know, it's a really great example of what, you know, real insider threats look like. In this case, there were a couple of guys that worked at Twitter, and they were providing information about, you know, IP addresses and email, things that could be used to attribute Twitter accounts that were, you know, relevant, presumably to the Saudis, back to the users and where they were accessing the network from, so that they could then be, you know, investigated or whatever other, you know, other bad things might
dismembered.
Bone sword. Well, yeah, that's kind of their thing now, isn't it?
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, this is, this has now been rolled up, but I mean, one of the guys in question, I think, went on to work for, was it Amazon after Twitter, which, yeah, this kind of insider threat for most organizations, and especially, you know, a company like Twitter that, you know, has, you know, really big user base across a bunch of things, you know, compartmentalizing a huge, really growing business like that enough to prevent insider attacks from being effective is very, very hard. And it's not a priority for most people, right? I mean, just growing, just keeping things running at all, let alone worrying about this kind of thing, you know, it takes an incident like this for people to focus on this kind of insider threat. And yeah, it's a good example, you know.
Oh, it's a great example. But I mean, you know, the fact remains that preventing this sort of thing is very hard.
Yeah, it is, right? I mean, preventing and compartmentalizing access to, you know, logs and usage information and all of the kind of internal software supply chains when you've got developers and sysadmins and SREs and all the people involved. And like, it's very, very complicated to do this well. And the only, you know, effective thing really is a very strong, you know, culture of privacy inside an organization where they have, you know, extensive logging, and you know that you can't log into a thing without it generating a massive log trail that even you as the sysadmin are going to have trouble kind of disrupting or making, you know, obscuring what you're up to. It's really, really hard to do. And I doubt that any organization's going to get that right the first, you know, few times they try and get there. It takes, you know, a bunch of practice, a bunch of effort. And, you know, I'm sure Twitter is thinking about what they've done and thinking about ways they can deal with this.
Yeah. Well, and moving to a, you know, completely sort of need to know model is going to slow things down as well. And that's, you know, that's always the balance, isn't it?
Yeah, especially for, you know, for cloud services that are, you know, one place where all this data lives and have to change all the time. And there's no real incentive to do it right because people don't get to see, right? You get to hide the nasty how the sausage is made bits of your cloud system, your cloud application away from the end users. And you can get away with a lot of really shoddy practices until this kind of thing happens, right?
Yeah.
And then you have to go back and kind of retrofit it.
Well, and that's the thing. You mentioned shoddy practices, and it's worth pointing out that from the looks of the indictment, it wasn't exactly challenging for these guys to do what they did.
No, and we've seen other examples of, you know, Uber, for example.
Yeah, I was thinking of their God mode, right?
Yeah, exactly, right? I mean, and when you are a young, scrappy startup and everyone's involved in everything, you know, that kind of thing just happens, right? You end up with these systems that, you know, that give everybody visibility, and, you know, that can be a really good thing early on because everyone gets all the insights about how the platform's being used. But when you've matured into a Google scale or an Azure or a Twitter, Facebook, something, you know, that's almost a utility for a lot of people, you have to change how you approach things. You can't keep that culture going. And, you know, the Uber situation, the Uber example was a good one where they, you know, they had to grow up from a startup into something that is now public transport or whatever it is that they do to make money. Well, not make money as the case may be.
Yeah, there was some interesting news out of Uber this week when one of the executives was doing an interview and was asked about Saudi Arabian involvement in the Uber company, and said, you know, was asked directly about Jamal Khashoggi and said something along the lines of, well, everyone makes mistakes.
God, I saw that.
Look, the executive did immediately walk it back, like when the interview finished, and then they've, you know, made a statement and stuff. But yeah, they just, you know, God.
You can just imagine brains, really. the poor PR people just smacking their heads, you know, sitting at the back going, oh, God.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. Sorry, honey, I won't be home for dinner this evening, pretty much for the PR people. But look, we got a similar case, obviously less serious. An insider at Trend apparently stole a bunch of customer data and was using that to pass on to a third party to commit sort of fraud type crimes. Looks like that person, fired and reported to law enforcement, etc.
That's another good small example. I think they were doing like phishing emails using customer details to make the emails more realistic, which, you know, that's a pretty neat scam. And you can certainly imagine that being picked up by crime groups, you know, where, you know, for smaller tier players like Trend, you know, rather than, you know, sort of nation state shenanigans like with the Saudis.
Oh, this one just hit today. The ACLU has had a court victory that, frankly, I wasn't expecting.
Yeah, this was quite startling, actually. The ACLU have been pushing a case through the US courts, kind of challenging the legality of the US government's ability to just kind of search everybody's devices at the border for non-US citizens. And they've come up with a ruling in court which says that that actually does require individualized suspicion. They have to have some reason to search your devices at the border, even when you're not from the freedom country, which...
That surprised me. Really surprised me. They say it's a Fourth Amendment problem. They can't just search you without having any sort of suspicion whatsoever. And this comes after a whole bunch of searches which look pretty inappropriate. People being told that, well, you know, I'm going through your phone here and I don't like what your friends are saying about, you know, the US government on their social media, so I'm going to deny you entry to the country, that sort of stuff. So that looks like how we got here. But I doubt this is over. This just smells like something that's going to get appealed. Oh, and it's worth pointing out too that they can still search devices now, but they just need to have some sort of, you know, their suspicion needs to have some sort of basis. They don't need warrants or anything.
No, but I mean, they used to have some kind of reason rather than just at random or just because they feel like it or just because they don't like where you're from or whatever, you know, whatever trumped up, you know, reason they're making up. There's some suggestion this also is going to apply to the kind of situation where, you know, the border laws apply, like, what is it, like 100 miles from the border, which kind of covers, you know, whole swathes of the US. And if you're a foreigner, you know, living in those bits, then you were potentially exposed to this, you know, far from the actual frontier as well. So, but you're right, this does seem like the sort of thing that's going to end up being appealed. I think this is a federal court in Boston, and this seems like the sort of thing that's just going to go upwards in the American court system and drag on for a while longer.
Yeah. But I mean, personally, I think it's probably not such a bad idea that authorities should have some sort of reason to inspect everyone's data all the time. You know, like, I just call me crazy, but it seems like a positive thing. I was pleasantly surprised by this ruling.
Yeah, and it's not exactly what we expect from Fortress America to be, you know, kind of toning down the anti-foreign alien searching and seizing.
You know, and certainly, you know, it won't have any bearing on what happens in Australia and New Zealand. I mean, we've seen some egregious abuse in our countries of this stuff. I believe I even looked up one case some time ago in New Zealand where the cops were giving customs basically the lists, you know, names of suspects where they couldn't really get a warrant, but they're like, hey, if they happen to go to Bali for a holiday, would you mind copying the contents of their phone, right? So it's sort of, you know, it has been used as a bit of a backdoor search warrant, you know, without the actual warrant part. backdoor device searches. So yeah, anyway, it's nice to see the US moving in the right direction on that, and let's just hope it doesn't get overturned on appeal. Now, look, I do want to touch briefly on the Corellium Apple lawsuit. There has been a bit of a development there. Of course, Corellium makes an iPhone emulator. Apple has decided to sue Corellium. You know, it's trying to sue Corellium into oblivion, saying that it violates its copyright. And, you know, the original complaint filed by Apple sort of threw a whole bunch of shade at Corellium, saying, oh, you know, they're sort of in the exploit supply chain, yada, yada. It was that sort of vibe. Now, Corellium did file its defense a couple of weeks ago. We didn't really discuss it on the show. Alex was the news guest that week. But one of the reasons we didn't discuss it is there were actually redactions in that lawsuit, in the response to the lawsuit that Corellium filed. Those redactions have now been removed, and it really does look like this lawsuit has resulted from a breakdown in negotiations between Apple and Corellium, where Apple were looking to buy Corellium and something's gone off the rails. I mean, that's what it looks like, right?
Yeah, that seems to be the suggestion from the back and forth, right? That there was a reasonable relationship between the two companies and that Corellium was, you know, participating in bug bounty programs, providing bugs that they've found with their emulating tools and presumably a bunch of other people who've been working on it, you know, to make it fit for the purpose of doing that kind of reverse engineering, finding bugs. Apple did seem keen, according to the, you know, kind of the scuttlebutt, according to the lawsuit and the write-ups that we've seen of it. Apple did seem keen about acquiring them, and then, yeah, now it's gone horribly wrong and they're getting sued. And the, you know, the kind of idea that they were, you know, that there's kind of copyright angles to it that Apple's pulling, you know, when they were cooperating earlier on does seem a bit sort of, I don't know, just seems a bit of a dick move to be.
Yeah,
to
I
be
mean, honest. It's, look, if you read the narrative, because the Corellium response actually has a narrative, whereas the Apple filing doesn't, you know? Now, look, I will say too that about, I think it was like something like 10 nights ago, I actually had dinner with the husband and wife team behind Corellium. They, Chris Wade, who is one of the founders of Corellium, he's actually from this part of Australia and happened to be around visiting family. So I said, well, you know, let's go get a meal. Full disclosure, they paid and it was delicious. So that was very nice. But look, I asked them a few questions that they were happy to answer on record. You know, given that Apple had sort of tried to imply, I mean, it felt like the lawsuit was trying to imply that they were sort of up to no good. I asked them just as an example, if NSO or Dark Matter had ever been customers of Corellium, and they said no to both of them. One staff member from Dark Matter had used the Corellium cloud platform to deliver some training at Black Hat, but that was just for the week. I think they gave it to him for free, and of course the access was revoked at the end of that. And they say that they very carefully vet their customers. This is something that they told me. And they also said that they've offered this tech in the past, before the lawsuit kicked up. They've offered it to Citizen Lab. They didn't take it up, but, you know, they offered free use to Citizen Lab. They like to think of themselves as responsible actors. And, you know, certainly I can tell you that they do not feel that this lawsuit is motivated by copyright, by concerns around copyright abuse, let's put it that way.
Right. Yes, I think people can read between that between that line. Dear, yeah. Just you think Apple could kind of be a little bit bigger than that, wouldn't you? You'd hope.
Oh, and the EFF is apparently helping out Corellium now as well on this. So I don't know. It just seems like everyone's lining up against Apple, but. Anyway, impossible to predict what's going to happen there. Moving on. And it was funny, right? Because a few weeks back, we spoke about a report, I think it was from CyberScoop as well, that Cyber Command were holding off on publishing North Korean malware because, you know, denuclearization talks were resuming. Those talks fell over, so Cyber Command has resumed dropping samples on VT. And looks like they're dropping some of the good stuff that the North Koreans have been using in these Swift hacks. So, I mean, from what I can gather, it's stuff that we've seen before, but maybe a few new variants of that malware.
Yeah, and it does also, it just kind of sends a message. I mean, the idea that they are going to dump this stuff in the public domain for everybody to look at and not just in kind of tight private threat intel circles, you know, that sends a message that their tradecraft's going to get burnt faster and more, you know, kind of more thoroughly.
We will pull your pants down.
Yes, exactly.
This next story from Brian Krebs is probably my favorite yarn this week. He has written up a study done by Vanderbilt University. It was first reported by the looks of things by PBS. It looks like maybe that's where Brian got onto this one. But it's a study that's looked at patient mortality in hospitals following ransomware attacks. And it looks like, given the type of remediation that hospitals put in place after ransomware attacks, it looks like that actually does affect mortality, particularly in the case of heart patients, because it takes patients in those hospitals something like 2.7 minutes longer to get on an electrocardiogram. I mean, this is just a mind-blowing report.
It is. It's a really interesting study, right? I mean, the idea that you would be able to go through and, you know, draw some direct correlation, you know, for how the computer systems are used and the quality of the patient care measured in terms of, you know, people having heart attacks, which is a pretty real metric. But what's kind of interesting is this, the study doesn't really talk about what, it doesn't even, I guess, speculate about what particular changes resulted in that, you know, adjustment in patient care outcome. whether that's the result of the increased security controls, whether that's the result of some other aspect of it. And of course, it's kind of natural to look at it and go, well, if there was no security controls at the hospital, I bet you they would get care even faster. Right, I mean, the same would be true in the other direction, right? If they just removed all of the passwords and no one had to log into anything, then everything would be way easier. And clearly that's also not a sensible thing to suggest. But, you know, if we're going to talk about that as the metric, you know, maybe no security is the right approach for this kind of environment. But, yeah, no, it's a really interesting study because it just kind of takes it out of the computer security realm or out of the IT realm and makes it very, very real about, you know, in the healthcare case, you know, people potentially dying.
Well, I just think it's a sad state of affairs when you can actually pull together a data set on this, right? When you've got actually enough hospitals that have been affected by ransomware that you can even start drawing statistically meaningful correlations and stuff. That shouldn't be the case.
Yeah, that is a particularly miserable thing to look at. And when I first read the study, I thought initially where it was going was, you know, this is when it's ransomware, like when the ransomware is currently stopping people from getting care, then the resulting delays cause people to, you know, have worse outcomes. But actually, no, this is about the remediation afterwards, which just doesn't say anything nice about IT, about security, about hackers, about, you know, ransomware crews, about anybody. We all come out of that.
It's not the feel good yarn of the year, is it?
Isn't.
It's just not. Moving on, and we've got a story here from Lily Hay Newman at Wired, looking at the issue of 5G security, and it turns out, you know, there are problems there, of course, and the new problems look an awful lot like the old problems, don't they, Adam?
Yeah, this is a write-up of a set of research coming out of Purdue University where they took some existing kind of 5G, you know, very early 5G tech stacks and went through and looked at a bunch of the bugs from previous 4G and earlier networks and looked at how those would then apply in a 5G environment and also went, you know, presumably found some other bugs while they're at it. And I mean, these are sort of design level things in some cases and limitations in, for example, the ability of 5G networks to anonymize users or to correctly hide the hardware identifiers as the temporary identifiers get rolled over time. But a bunch of things like that, some replay attacks. I mean, nothing that's really catastrophic, but, you know, all of the mobile network technology, you know, from GSM through to 5G has had this kind of issue with it. And the fact that they don't really, I mean, they learn the lessons gradually, but the whole kind of GSM consortium is a pretty slow-moving environment. The telco world is pretty slow-moving. And so the fact that there's kind of the same sorts of bugs makes a lot of sense. Whether this means anything for 5G rollouts versus the sorts of new bugs, the new and exciting bugs that we'll find once they've actually rolled some out. You know, I don't know whether these ones are the ones that are really going to, you know, worry everybody, but it's really good that there are people looking, and, you know, mobile tech in general is just super complicated. And these, you know, sorts of bugs, every time someone looks, they find, you know, weird edge cases for this kind of thing.
We should all just use iPod touches like Joe Cox, I think is the moral of the story.
If phone networks are just a bad time, we should just stick with IP. And, well, that's the thing with 5G, right? It's nearly all IP now, which is why we've got all the extra things to go wrong as well.
Hooray, hooray. This next one I just want to mention briefly. There has just been so much coverage of the issue of DNS over HTTPS. You listeners would have noticed a conspicuous absence of us discussing DNS over HTTPS, mostly because I don't really see the point talking about it, given that it's going to happen. Now, I know this is upsetting some ISPs. I know it is upsetting some regulators. I know it is upsetting some enterprises, which I don't quite understand because, you know, it's quite easy to enable DNS over HTTPS on your own domain name boxes, right, to get that sort of visibility. I don't see why this is getting so much attention. I don't get it. Adam, can you illuminate me?
Yeah, I don't know why this is getting so much attention either. I mean, this is kind of in the same way that we killed...
I should just mention too, we're talking about a piece here from ZDNet which says DNS over HTTPS will eventually roll out in all major browsers despite ISP opposition. I just thought this would be a good chance to dive into it, but go on.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the crux of the opposition against it is it removes a whole other tool that ISPs and governments and other people had to be able to control how, you know, their users were using the network. And we have kind of, you know, with TLS and the way that TLS now works with, you know, forward secrecy and SNI and bits and pieces like that, and even things like domain fronting, we've really kind of limited the options for doing traffic interception on the actual TCP streams. And so people have been relying very heavily on DNS for all of their their controls. And this is just going to take away the only real thing they had left, although there are some nuances between how the individual browsers do it, between Chrome and Firefox. There's a little bit of
difference. But this is the thing, right? Like Firefox sends it all to Cloudflare. I think Chrome basically just upgrades to DNS over HTTPS to your upstream resolver if it supports it. Like, what is the issue here?
Well, I mean, I guess the thing with the Chrome thing is that people will be able to change it, I guess. But yeah, the Firefox one obviously is a bit more aggressive. It does remain to be seen what Microsoft do, you know, with Edge or with their new kind of Chromium-based browser, whatever.
I mean, if this is a problem for you, you could just block Cloudflare's bloody DNS resolvers. Like, you know, that's an idea.
you could. But yeah, I mean, this is, you know, I know people are just too used to DNS and have too much invested in controlling DNS infrastructure. I mean, if you look at any big ISP DNS deployment, right, they're used to using it in this way, and that's just being taken away from them, and they're throwing their toys out of the cot. And you know, the Catalan's piece on ZDNet's kind of right in the sense, right? I mean, it's just going to happen. Deal with it. You're going to lose control of what your browsers and your end users were doing, and that's how the network was meant to work in the first place. So
I mean, the funniest argument to me is like, oh, malware might use it, and it's like, well, hang on, what's stopping malware from ever having already used it? Like, well, yeah, you know. I mean, it just it doesn't make sense. So you're kind of on the same page with me, which is this is inevitable. Stop complaining and just adapt.
Yeah, I mean, people were saying the same thing about, you know, doing TLS everywhere and about Let's Encrypt and about, you know, because it was the same set of controls they were used to. You know, people were used to being able to man in the middle TLS on the, you know, on the corporate edge by deploying, you know, CA certs out to all their machines, and now they can't because of cert pinning and transparency of things. Yeah. You know, the same thing happened there. The same arguments applied. People have dealt with that. They're going to deal with this.
Yeah. And I, you know, even I had a good old QQ about Let's Encrypt in the early days, just going, it's going to enable, you know, phishing, TLS encrypted phishing at scale, which it did, but we've adapted. World's still spinning, right? World is still spinning. We've got another one here from Catalin Kimpanu over at ZDNet, and apparently phones and PCs sold in Russia will have to come pre-installed with Russian apps, which is apparently a measure designed to prop up the local tech sector. A cynic might suggest there is perhaps another motivation there. But look, this comes, there's a bit of wider context here. This comes as, you know, many listeners would have no doubt heard about Russia's plan to sort of be able to disconnect itself from the internet. And a lot of commentators are saying that's really, they just want to change the routing flows in Russia so that they can get themselves more into a, you know, Great Firewall of China sort of position. This looks a little bit like that as well. What's your take, Adam?
Yeah, I mean, it does seem like it gives them a bunch of control they haven't previously had. It lets them push, you know, domestic alternatives to some of the big overseas web properties on the big, you know, apps that that people are using. So it gives them a, you know, a chance to get their apps in front of people, gives them a bit more control. But yeah, the overall strategic goal of being able to run the Russian internet separately from the rest of the world, if they need to in an emergency or if they want to for various other reasons, you know, in the style of the Great Firewall of China, you know, it makes sense that it fits with their strategic plan there. Whether or not it also props up the local tech industry, you know, I'm sure it will. Whether or not it gives them, you know, options to backdoor stuff or other ways to control software supply chain, probably also the case. I mean, we think about all of the crappy, you know, pre-installed software you get on you know, Windows machines you buy from, you know, from the major OEMs. I mean, the same sort of thing happening for all of the devices in a country with a, you know, it just kind of gives you a whole, you know, another set of things to go wrong. And for their, you know, the health of their overall ecosystem, it seems like a bad idea to push a bunch more crapware onto people's machines and onto people's phones and that kind of thing. It's just kind of more stuff to get Russians owned, but I don't know that they're thinking about it from that perspective.
It's less about getting things like, you know, Gmail and Google Maps, and it's going to look more like the Yahoo toolbar of old, isn't it? You know, but in Russian.
Yes.
Capital One's chief security officer has had a change of title, shredded the old business cards, and is now a senior vice president of something, advising on cybersecurity, something. But essentially, it looks like the CISO at Capital One has been moved out of that role.
Yeah, and I mean, to be honest, I can't imagine what it's like being in a place like that after, you know, going through a really big breach like that and having to deal with all of the rubbish. Like, you'd probably just want to table flip and walk out. So maybe he's on, you know, maybe this is kind of a way to, you know, keep whatever, you know, retirement fund or whatever other thing.
Well, it's either it's either an execution or a seppuku, you know. I mean,
yeah, one or the other. Either way, it cannot be a fun thing. I know, like, at KawaiiCon, just been, Fobsky talked about his experience being at Equifax as a security guy during
I haven't watched that yet. He sent me the link.
Yeah, cinnamon. It does have a very, you know, it has a bunch of personal impact when you're in the middle of that kind of shitstorm. So I wouldn't begrudge the guy who decided he wanted a quieter life, even if it is still at Capital One.
I will
One.
Say, you know, I mean, I know Alex Stamos a little, and not that, you know, there was a breach per se at Facebook, but certainly there were a few things to deal with when he was CISO there. And he certainly looks a lot healthier these days.
Yeah.
You know, God, I can't imagine. Anyway, we got some fancy malware to talk about this week, Adam. This is like, you know, 24-karat malware.
Yeah, we've seen a write-up of this piece of malware called Titanium, run by a group called Platinum. It's been seen deployed. The group has been seen targeting mostly Southeast Asian countries. This particular piece of malware, yeah, it's pretty fancy. Some pretty fancy looking C2, like moves its data around in steganographed PNG files, and you know, a lot of work in making the C2 look kind of sensible on the network, and you know, lots of crypto and pretending to be commonly installed software. A pretty reasonably good quality piece of malware that's been
champagne malware.
Yes, the finest. But interestingly, we haven't seen any reports of it actually being deployed. So I'm not quite sure where.
Well, where did Kaspersky get it from? You know, that's what I wondered.
Well, yeah, maybe they nicked it off the developers who are running Kaspersky on their box. I don't know.
It has been known to happen before, but we won't talk about that because it's a sensitive topic among some people.
We don't mention.
We shall not mention. Prone to Owns going on, and they've been going after smart TVs and IoT things. The Amazon Echo didn't have a good time. Facebook Portal survived, but it seems to be, when you read the story, because no one was really interested in doing anything to it.
Yeah, I was going to say, I had to go, what's a Facebook Portal when I read the piece? Because I'd never heard of it. But of course, Prone to Own has had a long history of breaking all sorts of things. It does seem a little bit kind of low rent to go after, you know, like
TP-Link routers. TP-Links
and stuff.
I was seeing that and I'm like, that's not like when they were hacking iPhones, you know? This is
No, exactly. Like hacking a Sony smart TV. Like, come on. But yeah. No, but there's some real, you know, that's not fair. There are some real bugs, and you read through some of the teams that have been hitting things and they're doing real hacking, you know, proper memory corruption bugs in the browser, rendering engines and, you know, busting out the sandboxes. And, you know, there is, apart from the TP-Links and the Netgears, there is some real work being done. And it's kind of nice to see this stuff getting attention. But not everything needs to be about, you know, iPhones and Windows and Chrome. You know, loads of people get loads of TP-Links, lots of own. So,
well, and the thing is, you know, this stuff, you can't avoid it anymore. You know, I bought a soundbar recently and I had to put it on my Wi-Fi network or it wouldn't work, right? Like,
yeah, exactly.
It's just like, no Wi-Fi. And I'm like, I just want you to play the movies. And it's I need internet access. So yeah, it's coming. And that bloody thing's got a microphone in it because it supports, you know, these voice assistant things that I'm not really interested in. God. And God, man, you know, now I've got to get a screwdriver, get in there and actually find the microphone so and I can remove it. Yep. Yeah, exactly, right. That's a job for summer. Anyway, you know, this is a Neo Luddite Pat getting in there with the wire clippers, taking out the old microphones there. Oh, this is, look, I shouldn't laugh because this is going to cause mayhem. something like most Magento online stores are going to get EOL'd next year. That's the 1X branch, which apparently, according to this piece, is most of them. So they're going to be EOL, no more support, and I'm sure that'll be fine because no one ever targets Magento websites.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of mom and pop, little web e-commerce stores that have relied on Magento for a long time. The 1X tree is going to go end of life middle of next year, June 2020. No security patches. I'm sure if anyone's sitting on Magento bugs at the moment, they're just going to wait for those, to become ever bugs.
Just going to wait for them to mature yes, exactly. Until they develop the right nose.
So, of course, Magento is owned by Adobe, which does have a, you know, reasonable history on killing software. So, maybe they do understand how to sunset, the bulk of their user base, like they had to do with Flash and, Acrobat and all those kinds of things. Maybe they have some insight into how to, you know, cause 250,000 e-commerce sites to go away.
Well, when the fire starts, like, you know, usually a company like Adobe will actually come to the party with some patches, right? You would think.
With some late patches.
But yeah, we've seen Microsoft do that, you know?
Yeah, we've seen them with some of the XP, what was it? They patched XP after end of life. They patched 2003 after end of life. So, yeah, it might happen. But then again, the sorts of people who have 1X, you know, many, many, many-year-old Magento boxes probably don't apply the patches anyway.
Yeah, Yeah.
Otherwise, they might be on the new one.
There you go. That's the weirdest glass half full take, I think, ever.
And the moral of the story is don't buy anything from tiny web stores. You're just going to have a bad time.
Here's another one. A major ASP.NET hosting provider has been ransomwared. They apparently have 440,000 customers. And the grim part is looks like a lot of customers use this like ASP.NET hosting provider to do like back-end processing. So it might not have killed their pretty, you know, front-end websites, but it's just crushed all their data. Yay.
Yeah, I mean, this is the challenge of sticking your applications off into some managed hosting provider, you know, whether it's a .NET one or whatever it happens to be, because, yeah, you don't necessarily know how good a job they do. I mean, maybe their availability is great, but in this case, the company in question called Smarter ASP.NET, ironic, they got themselves ransomware, but also all of their corp systems ransomware. But, yeah, everybody's databases and other applications that were running on their platform are ransomware. It's not the first hosting provider, like this kind of application hosting provider we've seen get owned. We have seen, there was a big South Korean one that got owned a couple of years ago now, and they ended up paying a very big ransom to try and bring their service back, because clearly backups were not their thing either. But it's not a good look. And I mean, there's so much stuff that that runs in these kind of, you know, 5-10-year-old sort of, you know, backwater areas of the internet that, you know, sort of predate modern cloud stuff, where things can go really wrong very quickly.
Yeah, I'll say. Or alternatively,
I shouldn't laugh.
And how? Basically. Nazis having a bad time, which is, you know, I don't often enjoy reading about forums getting owned unless they're, you know, criminals, people who do bad things to children, or Nazis, in which case it's okay to celebrate. And yeah, this looks to be a fairly significant data breach in Nazi land that could have some real consequences for current active Nazis, which is pretty exciting.
Yeah, this is a forum called Iron March, which is, you know, I gather some manner of relatively high-profile Nazi forum from a while ago. It's kind of gone, or had been taken down a while ago, but somebody clearly had owned it in the past, or has subsequently owned copies of it that were, you know, that were floating around after it had been turned off. Anyway, full database dumps showed up on Internet Archive, of all places, and people have been rummaging through, and, you know, with email addresses and sign-up information and IP addresses, you know, trying to go find actual people who were using this forum and posting nasty Nazi stuff.
People who might have good OPSEC now but didn't back then. That's the interesting thing.
Yeah,
right?
Which is the, you know, the classic way of busting people, you know, getting them earlier on in their radicalization, going and finding the trails that they left then. Interestingly enough, the data has now gone from Internet Archive. It was here, it was there, you know, a couple of days ago when the reporting started to happen, but it is actually removed for terms of service reasons since then. But I'm sure
there's a few copies available floating around, man.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be hard to come by.
Meanwhile, 8chan has tried to rebrand itself as 8kun and trying to get back online. And I've been following Frederick Brennan on Twitter. Frederick is, of course, the original founder of 8chan, who has come to believe that it is it's an abomination that should never be allowed back onto the internet again. And he's been writing all of the letters to these hosting providers saying, just so you're aware, you're kind of involved in the reborn 8chan. And then they keep having their service pulled. It's just been a really interesting few weeks. And I've been paying attention to that because I have been curious. You know, Cloudflare often said, well, if we kick them off our protection, they're just going to wind up going somewhere else. And that hasn't been the case, right? They have not been able to get stable service anywhere else, and that's continuing. But this is an interesting story because one of the ways they briefly got onto the ClearNet was a little bit shady.
Yeah, they were being hosted for a while at one of the kind of weird Russian crime hosting kind of, you know, bulletproof hosting providers, VanwareNet, and they were advertising address space they didn't own. And then that's where the 8kun services were running, you know, in address blocks that they were, you know, weren't currently being advertised by somebody else, but they had no right to use, and they were just advertising them via the BGP onto the backbone. And at least then if someone goes to try and figure out, you know, where it's being hosted, they look up the Whois records, it points to some completely unrelated organization, I think in Europe, wherever it was they were stealing it from. But yeah, that kind of, you know, taking over swamp space and reusing it. We've seen a bunch of people use it. And the Russian, you know, bulletproof hosting people have been doing that for a bunch of other places. Whether doing it for 8chan is a good idea, I mean, because it draws attention.
Yeah, I mean, that's not what I'd say is sustainable. I wrote a tweet kind of about all of this the other week saying, you know, these, Tor Onion services and other similar, you know, technologies. They're not there yet, but I wonder if they're going to get stable and work at scale in the future, you know, and what's that world going to look like. But then someone wrote a very good reply. I can't remember who it was. Forgive me. But they said, and it's the year of Linux on the desktop. Which I thought was a good retort. There's some really interesting little details in this piece, actually, that was written by Sean Gallagher. One of them is that the slash poll from 8chan has sort of migrated onto Telegram, which is something that people said, yeah, you know, they'll just go to Telegram. They've only got 633 subscribers, and I'd hazard a guess that 3/4 of them are journalists, law enforcement, and threat intel people.
Well, exactly right, and that's why you don't necessarily want to go sign up now, because it's too scary, right? Because you know there's too many eyes on it, and you know you're just going to get, you know, one OPSEC screw up, you're going to have a bad time, and everyone's kind of staying away, running scared. In the same way that we've seen people, you know, deal with the, you know, the big underground marketplaces going away as well. That you know that the next marketplace is going to be a front, and you're going to get snapped, and yeah, I think people are running a bit scared from the amount of attention given to 8chan.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all interesting stuff. I'm going to move on into, we've got three stories here all about Microsoft stuff. Well, two Microsoft stories and one link to a Microsoft blog post. They're doing some cool stuff lately. Like one of the things they're trying to do is rewrite some Windows components in Rust, which is, of course, is a relatively, you know, it is quite a memsafe language. That's interesting. And so far, they say, it's going pretty well.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, Microsoft got great data about what sorts of things, what sorts of bugs, bug classes they've seen. Memory corruption clearly is one of the big classes of bugs they've had. It makes sense if they can to go back and rewrite some components that are particularly risky, or if they're building new things to do so in a memory-safe language. Rust is a good fit for that, being kind of like a C-like systems programming sort of language, but with a bunch of memory safety constraints. There's been some kind of discussion based on Microsoft's experience about what was lacking for them, what they're thinking about. Sounds like they're probably going to contribute upstream to try and build on that. And yeah, it seems like a good thing for Microsoft to be doing.
And, you know, we got this bit of an update here from the corporate vice president of Microsoft Security. This one's dated November 4. Just walking through some initiatives at Microsoft. I mean, it's just weird, isn't it, when you read through their stuff. They're doing good stuff. They are doing good stuff.
Yeah, now Microsoft has really been picking up their game. I mean, they've, at least as far as security is concerned, I mean, I guess they're doing better than they have been at some points in the last 20 years for other things as well. But they have. They've been doing a good job in security things. I mean, some of their threat intel stuff, Microsoft ATP, the advanced threat protection stuff they've been delivering out of Azure, you know, there's a bunch of things that are genuinely useful. And there's some initiatives that are talked about in this blog post that I didn't even know about.
Yeah.
Which are, you know, things like bringing sandboxing to Office 365. So they'll have individual virtualized containers for opening unsafe documents, like really extending the protected Office environment into the same way that they've been doing that for browser components, like actually using the virtualization and the same for storing credentials in virtualized.
Yeah, they're doing like, it's like a micro virtualized thing, you know, like it's badass.
Yeah, and of course the, you know, the scale of Azure and Office 365 has really given them some good things to work on the kind of threat intel, you know, event processing, security monitoring sort of area, and they've been pushing out a bunch of products that do quite well. Obviously, they've also a lot of experience in responding to people's Active Directories getting owned and the, you know, the kind of level of detection and data that you get out of those systems. Does seem quite a bit better than some of the other SIEM and security vendors, you know, the security monitoring vendors that we interact with as, you know, as aggressors. The Microsoft one is the one that we're kind of more scared of than average. So yeah, they really are doing a bunch of good work, and it's kind of nice to see it all lined up. They were talking at a conference about, you know, all of the initiatives or some of the initiatives that they are taking. And yeah, I mean, it's good job Microsoft. It's weird.
Yeah, and they're just rolling out. They're going to apply California's new fairly strict privacy law to all US users. I don't think that's motivated by them just, you know, going, yay, privacy. I mean, I'm sure that's a part of it. But I think this is more, you know, what you and I spoke about a few weeks ago, that, you know, the United States just has such a patchwork of privacy laws. You're probably better off just picking the strictest one and complying to it, because it's going to make your life easier.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's in much the same way we've seen people applying GDPR well outside of Europe, just because if you've got to do it one place, it's easier to do it everywhere than half do it. You know, do it for only the user base that it applies to. And I'm sure this is the case here as well. I mean, they're spinning it to be, oh, look, we care about privacy, which, I mean, maybe, as you said, maybe they do. But I do think, yeah, you're right. The real motivation is it's just like you may as well pick the absolute strictest one, and then you don't have to worry about whatever, you know, Alabama comes up with.
Oh, good story out of Google now. They're apparently going to work with some AV companies to try to tidy up the Android Play Store. This is interesting, actually, that they have opted to partner with external parties to do this.
Yeah, it sounds like this is the thing they've been working on quietly for a couple of years now, working with vendors like ESET, Lookout, and Zimperium to kind of build a way to scan Android apps as they go into the Play Store and to do so at large enough scale for it to be helpful and useful for them. I mean, some of these vendors, I'm sure, have been having quite a lot of fun using, deploying their particular scanning techniques at Google scale with Google support. Let's face it, anything Google does to improve the quality of things that end up in the Play Store, probably going to help, and so good on them, I guess.
Yeah, well, good on them good on them if it works, basically. We've got a report here looking at some research that's been done against, secure enclave SDKs. That is kind of interesting.
Yeah, this was some academics that have been looking at the SDKs provided for you to write software that use secure enclaves. They looked at a couple of open source ones and also Intel's one that they provide, Microsoft's one, and some of the other more general ones that run on top of Intel's enclave hardware. They came up with a bunch of bugs, a bunch of bug classes that they found calling into functions in the secure enclave, a whole bunch of bugs. And obviously, yeah, it's good work. I mean, given that the interfaces of these devices really do need to be pretty locked down and pretty robust for them to do what they're supposed to do.
Yeah. Now, this next one is just mind blown. You remember that really bad Confluence bug? It was like the template injection bug. We got the NSA putting out warnings about this one now, which is just, and this is one, and it's unusual that we do this, but even when we were on the show saying, I even brought Shubs onto the show to talk about that bug, and we were saying, everybody go patch it now. This one's really bad, right? And here we are months later, and sure enough, it's so bad that the National Security Agency of the United States is like, go patch your Confluence boxes.
And even then, the press officer from the NSA is like, when we put out advisories like this, we're doing so for a reason, It's not just fun. Maybe you should patch your Confluence.
Yeah.
I guess patch your Confluences. And Atlassian, maybe don't put so many bugs in the Confluences in the first place.
Yes. That one was particularly... easy. That was the issue there. But yeah, free for all apparently, and it's bad enough for the NSA to get involved. There you go, 2019, folks. Look, we've got a few more stories in the list, but we're going to have to wrap it up now because we're kind of out of time. But we've just got a few other stories. There's one about a bit of disclosure drama between Intel and a bunch of researchers. I've got two different write-ups on that one from Kim Zetter, reporting for the New York Times. Well done, Kim. And Andy Greenberg with his version over at Wired. And we've got a good story from Motherboard by Joe Cox about people who have previously helped people get their Instagram accounts back when they've been owned. They're now charging to do that because it's so much work. And I recently did help someone get their Instagram back, and I can assure you that their reset and account recovery flows are absolutely terrible. So there's just some interesting reading material for anyone who's into it. Links are in the show notes. Adam, it is so good to have you back on the program. Alex and Pipes did a wonderful job, but talking to you, my friend, it's like putting on my favorite pair of slippers.
Well, no, it's nice to be back. I had a good time not thinking about computers, but I came back and everything is still much as it was, all terrible and really interesting.
But so much fun. So much fun.
But yeah, lots of fun.
Okay,
yeah,
mate. We'll wrap it up now, and we'll chat to you again next week.
You will indeed. I'll talk to you then, Pat.
That was Insomnia Security's Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's news headlines. It is time for our sponsor interview now with Stefan Chanet. Stefan is the co-founder of AttackIQ, where he serves as CTO. AttackIQ is a really interesting company that was, in my view, well ahead of its time when it was founded. AttackIQ makes an attack simulation and control validation platform. The idea is that you deploy some testing agents throughout your enterprise. They stimulate various attacker-like behavior, and then the detection of that behavior by your security gear can be observed and measured by the AttackIQ platform. It basically measures how well your security controls are working. So if you've got EDR that should catch behavior X, you can actually test that your security gear is detecting behavior X accurately. If it doesn't, you might want to look at making some changes, whether that's tuning or bringing in some other detection or some other control. Now, Attack IQ was founded in 2013 before MITRE ATT&CK was a thing that came along a couple of years later. And yeah, ATT&CK just ties in so nicely with what Attack IQ is all about. The tie-in is so good, in fact, that it's hard to believe Attack IQ didn't name itself after MITRE ATT&CK, but there's a funny story about that that you'll hear in this interview. And a quick note, too, at one point in this interview, I go on off on a bit of a tangent about CVSS that I didn't really set up properly. The reason I mention CVSS is that it's an earlier attempt to help communicate security concepts in a simplified way, but CVSS has copped a bit of criticism because CVSS scores don't really do much to communicate context. So you can see bugs where it's a 3 if condition X is met and a 9-point something if condition Y is met. And that's why I randomly started talking about CVSS's lack of nuance in a discussion about MITRE ATT&CK, which is a nuanced framework for communicating security concepts. Anyway, here is my interview with Stefan. And before we got going, he said some CISOs are treating MITRE ATT&CK a little bit like Pokemon Go. Gotta catch them all. When really the whole point of ATT&CK is to be able to target and prioritize your efforts in a way that's relevant to your environment and the attacker's targeting you. So here's Stefan.
I think that it really came out of the fact that the last few years, MITRE ATT&CK has blown up. Everybody's running, trying to figure out what to do with it and thinking that you just check every box, that you cover every technique. I think it's less, you know, what MITRE did with their evaluations and all the vendors coming and saying, well, we check every box, because in fact, through the evaluations, they didn't check every box. They said, well, here's the EDR vendors and here's, you know, where the focus point of detection and prevention is. I just think it's, you know, the industry themselves misunderstanding really how to put MITRE ATT&CK and operationalizing it.
Because the temptation is, right, if you're a vendor, even if you're a user, if you're a CISO, you see that white space on the ATT&CK matrix and you know, the tendency is you just want to tick every box. But, you know, why don't we start with like, describing the ideal use for MITRE ATT&CK. You're a CISO, you want to get familiar with it, you want to use it as a tool. How do you even get started?
Yeah, I think this was, you know, there was a lot of great things to come out of MITRE ATT&CK. I really appreciated the talk that Nationwide gave on their case study, how they put ATT&CK into action. I gave a lightning talk on really giving your security maturity, where you can start, you know, as you start adding more capabilities, where you can kind of continue to use MITRE ATT&CK. And so I looked at it as I gave my talk from the perspective of you're just starting off your security program. Don't go jump and use MITRE ATT&CK in the use case of adversarial emulation, because you got nearly, you know, 5 major areas that MITRE ATT&CK talks about, major core use cases, using it as a reference architecture, assessment engineering, detection analytics, threat intelligence, and then adversarial emulation. So obviously, when you're just getting started with your security program, or if you want to jump and start using MITRE ATT&CK, just use it as a reference library. I think this is incredibly powerful. And when I was at MITRE ATT&CK just a few weeks ago, what was discussed was the cultural shift. You know, before many of the orgs said that they thought of themselves as compliance and standards driven, but as they started to incorporate the language of MITRE ATT&CK, just as their analysts spoke or wrote up notes, they started to speak from a perspective of the adversary. And that started just to shift how they thought about their security program. So that's really where to get started. It's just, you know, using the common lexicon, common language of MITRE ATT&CK.
Now, one thing you said earlier before we started recording, which I found pretty interesting, is, you know, probably the first thing you want to do is actually try to look at what security technology you already have and then map that across to the MITRE ATT&CK matrix to see what you should already be covering, but that you might not necessarily be covering.
Yeah, and I think that's a really interesting point. So from ATT&CK IQ's perspective, you know, we focus on several areas to operationalize MITRE ATT&CK. And many don't realize one of the things that we can provide is actually listing all of your security technologies. So we have all of these integrations that can hook into your log management or, you know, your aggregation points. And then we can actually provide a complete visibility. What are your 110 security technologies and processes in your security stack? This is huge, because then once you actually have visibility into your security stack, then you can start to understand what are the capabilities that I have and how effective are those capabilities?
Yeah. So what should I have versus what I actually have? Not always the same thing, right? And then I guess it comes down to starting to, check off some more boxes. And that's where it gets really interesting, isn't it? Because you don't just want to tick every box. That's the whole point of MITRE ATT&CK is to allow people to actually figure out where to best guide their efforts. And there is this tendency at the moment for someone to go, oh, they just want to bust out that pen and go tick, 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 and tick off every box. But that is completely the opposite of the point to MITRE ATT&CK. It must stop.
Completely agreed. And so I think that there's two ways to approach it, and both are correct. The nationwide talk that was at MITRE ATT&CK, they really changed their entire security program by actually having some of their team members go and understand from their insurance industry perspective what adversaries were targeting their particular industry. And it was a handful of adversaries. Then they looked at MITRE ATT&CK and understood what particular technique do those adversaries use. And instead of the 266 some techniques, I think they dwindled it down to about 67 techniques to start focusing on.
That doesn't mean you stop there, but it does give you the starting point, doesn't it? And those 67, they're going to keep you busy for a while. And why not target, the things that are most likely to burn you? I mean, this is what it's for. It's about prioritizing, not trying to boil the ocean by ticking every box. You start with the items in the matrix that are going to get you the furthest, the quickest.
Yeah. And one thing that was very powerful that they showed in their presentation, and that we've actually helped a lot of our customers show as well, is, what is the effectiveness of your coverage given your current technologies? And if you want to go justify more spending on new security capabilities, you have this incredibly powerful data-driven platform now to be able to go do that. Here's the 67 techniques, given, say, Nationwide's example of what we are being targeted for. And here's our gaps. Here's what we have shown to have effective coverage for. And now you actually have a data-driven conversation. It's extremely powerful. So that's one approach, is actually take the adversarial approach from, who's targeting us and understanding the techniques to focus on. The other, in reverse, is to look at the technologies that you have, given the visibility, and then look at the assumptions you have as to why did you buy those technologies, what techniques do they cover from a detection and prevention perspective to allow your teams to respond to. And then now you go forward and start testing that as well. So one's a kind of approach, taking a defensive standpoint of what tools and technologies you have, and the other is what adversaries are after us, and do we have the proper tools and technologies for that coverage?
See, I can't figure out if you've got a crystal ball or if you just got really lucky starting this business of yours, and then MITRE ATT&CK comes along and actually makes it super relevant. Because I think, you're 6 years into this, right? 6 years ago, this business of yours was kind of like, geez, I couldn't see it being so relevant today. I mean, how did you do that? Teach me how.
Yeah. I wish I had a crystal ball, but you're right. I mean, we started ATT&CK IQ in 2013. MITRE ATT&CK was released 2015. We started having our first conversations with the ATT&CK team in 2016. And it was absolutely fortunate for the entire continuous security validation space, breach and attack, simulation market, that ATT&CK came around to be that standardized framework. Because up until that point, we had a platform that could validate all your technologies and perform adversarial emulation, but against what framework to thus then communicate amongst your team? And we didn't want to come up with the standard framework. We were really looking outside to someone like MITRE to do that. And, lo and behold, we were lucky. The entire industry was lucky. And I think it really saved our market and really, accelerated it. Gartner actually puts breach and attack simulation as a market category as a pretty strong market category as far as the talk of the town. At Gartner Security Summit,
hot like Hansel, so hot right now. It's interesting, isn't it? Because ATT&CK IQ actually predates MITRE ATT&CK, doesn't it?
It does.
This is so the funny thing, because you got to tell the listeners the story about the name, because it is an awesome name.
Yeah. So, when as a founder, I'm sitting there with my other co-founder, Rajesh Sharma, and you know, we're trying to come up with how to name the company. So of course, one of the important aspects is that the domain name is available so that you can have the website for it. And so at the time we were using DreamHost, and we're typing in a bunch of different names, attack, threat, risk, into these and coming up with a bunch of, you know, add-on names after that. Everything we tried was taken. And DreamHost actually comes back and says, well, might we suggest Attack IQ? And Raj and I look at each other, we're like, yes, you may.
Yeah, that's great. Like, when has anybody ever been suggested an actually good domain name in an auto-suggestion, like, engine? That doesn't happen, man. Like, it feels like this was all, you know, predestined somehow.
Yeah, so the origin story when I tell it to the entire team at Attack IQ is always, well, the internet essentially named the company.
And along comes MITRE ATT&CK. Now, what I find interesting about this is, because I remember when CVSS came along as a thing, and there was a lot of criticism of CVSS because it lacked nuance, right? Now, we certainly could not say the same thing about MITRE ATT&CK, and I think that's what makes it good. And this is something that I've spoken on the show, though, is like a potential pitfall could actually be sprawl. In MITRE ATT&CK. It's something that I was sort of a little bit concerned by, but I'm not sure that I'm so worried about that anymore because generally everything in it seems to be pretty well defined. What do you think?
It is, and you know, well, I agree. And I think that the MITRE ATT&CK team, you know, it was a fantastic feeling being at that conference. You know, there was, I think, 250 attendees, completely sold out, streamed to thousands of individuals. I bring that up because it had an extremely, you know, community feel to the entire conference. And so they are listening to all the requests and all the problems that MITRE ATT&CK has, and it has many. And so, you know, one of the issues was this notion that you've got these layers of techniques, but look, something like credential dumping has several different methods to perform credential dumping. So they introduce sub techniques, all right? Yeah. And so more context.
But this is kind of what I'm talking about, sprawl. Like, how long before that becomes sub techniques? And is that going to happen? And could this get out of hand? And even if it does wind up being that nuanced, like too nuanced and complicated, does it then become like a navigable framework that you use via some sort of tool, right? Instead of just being something that you can look at on a piece of paper. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. I just sort of wonder where it's going to go, right?
Yeah, and I think it had to do with more, you know, separating out these techniques to make them usable. Because before you'd find something like credential dumping, and there were so many ways to do that, and so you'd read in a text file that linked to that technique the 9 possible ways.
Yeah,
and
stops mimicatch actually, doesn't stop XYZ, right?
Yeah, exactly. So I agree with what you're saying, Patrick, and I think that, you know, this is luckily, hopefully, up to the community to help guide this and make sure that doesn't happen. The other aspect I thought that was a discussion that I was having with the attack team and the Attack IQ team is this notion of emulation plans that I hope is more and more a focus point, where you're not just running individual techniques. It's something that Attack IQ has focused on quite a bit to say, you know, a technique on itself might be valuable, you know, but if you look at some of those techniques like launch CTL and others, they're not malicious on their own. PowerShell it's all about context.
So, you know, this is what I mean, though, at some point,
all about context.
At some point, this has to go stateful, right? And then it's not a paper and pen exercise anymore, which is kind of what makes it really cool at the moment. You know, then it's like a much more complicated framework. I'm not saying it doesn't have value, but I'm saying it has a different kind of value. Does that make sense?
It does, and it was actually part of the talk that I gave that was the lightning talk, which was let's look at MITRE ATT&CK and let's look at the use cases as a point of reference for your, you know, growing security maturity. So start using it as a reference library. Start using it to overlay your controls and understanding what techniques that you cover. Then start, you know, tuning your detection analytics. Then start incorporating the language into your threat intelligence and threat hunting capabilities. And then let's start talking about emulation plans and adversarial emulation. These are all the core use cases of MITRE ATT&CK that they promote. But this isn't something where you just jump to kind of the end without actually going through and making sure you have a foundation for how you're incorporating MITRE ATT&CK.
Well, thank you for joining us to talk about where the beginning is, because it is good to start at the beginning And a lot of people, I'd imagine, are not. That's just the way these things go. But look, we've been, as you know, we've been talking a lot about MITRE ATT&CK on the show lately. And, you know, I think it's super cool. I'm excited to see where it goes. I think it's fantastic that the world has sort of aligned itself around the products that you decided to develop 6 years ago. Steph and Chanette, it's been a real pleasure to chat to you, and we'll talk to you again next year.
Thanks, Patrick.
That was Stefan Chanette there with a chat about MITRE ATT&CK and his company, ATT&CK IQ. Big thanks to ATT&CK IQ for its sponsorship of the Risky Business Podcast. Funnily enough, too, after that interview was finished, Stefan and I had a really interesting discussion about how some of his customers are starting to use ATT&CK simulation to do continuous validation of security controls instead of point-in-time exercises. And that was actually pretty interesting. So I'm guessing that'll be our next chat. But that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.